2022. The following is an interview of Ms. Lucille Bell Southwell of Beeville, Texas, concerning generally her experiences as a daughter of a Texas preacher evangelist, Brother Samuel Barnes Bell, who was active at the turn of the century and afterwards, and specifically with her references to the characteristics of the Methodist Episcopal Church of that same time period.
My father came to San Antonio, and they were all aglow. I was a baby, and they thought it was wonderful. They'd never been to Texas, and San Antonio came to San Antonio, and he was to get an appointment. He had corresponded with the powers that be, the bishop and all, and they told him to come on. And he did, and landed at Travis Park, and the pastor of the Travis Park Church, which was a big church in San, the only church in San Antonio. We were guests in the parsonage of old Dr. Harris, who was the pastor and a bachelor. And so when the conference came right away, they gave this young preacher a mission. And he had a good church, and they came from Morgan City, Louisiana, and had a two-story parsonage. And he had nothing when they just read him out as missionary in San Antonio. And he very nearly had a starvation time for a while. And preachers at that time were paid just barely existence. Even the pastors of the city churches didn't get big salaries, but they were better, of course, than the poor little preachers that had the poor little churches. And I remember when I was a child, when we lived in West End in San Antonio, across from San Antonio Female College.
Here Mrs. Southwell mentioned her father's telling her of one parson who made a salary of $3,000 a year.
And he just thought that salary was fabulous. And I remember then, several years later, when we built our home on McKinley Avenue in San Antonio, and this may not be relevant, that he was making $1,800 a year, and he thought he had gone up the ladder quite a bit, and making payments on a home.
Yeah.
And then at that time I was about 11 years old, I guess, they made him district evangelist. And they somehow found that he could very easily get money out of people. And they didn't have any money. The churches were poor. And San Antonio was growing and had at least one church, Travis Park, down there, Boston, San Antonio. And St. Anthony went there then. And they gave him the job of organizing, see, San Antonio was growing, of organizing suburban churches. And they knew that he did good, and he was well adapted to evangelistic work. And he managed to get hold of a tent, and he would find a lot in different suburban districts, and he organized every suburban church in San Antonio with a tent, and most of these outlying districts except Laurel. Now, he did not organize Laurel Heights. That came later, and that was the second church, and it was Ridge Church, but the others were poor. And where the money came from, I don't know. They were working people, but he got it. And I can show you when we come in from San Antonio. There's been a house on it many, many years, where this first tent was put up, and he held services, and just a few people would come. And then finally, he got hold of enough money to buy on the corner of McKinley Avenue and Prepa two lots, and had and they built a house, a square house, sort of like my house, without the partitions in it, and that was the church. Outwardly, it was a nice cottage, but that was the first church. And then later they converted that into the parsonage, put the partitions and the plumbing and all, years later. Mm-hmm. And that house is still there back behind the church. And every church, every suburban church in San Antonio was started that way. I think that's quite something. Mm-hmm. He never did get any big plaudits for what he did and all. But then after that church grew and was well established, then all of these others, South San Antonio and Prospect Hill and Alamo Heights and I don't know. All of, except maybe two or three, that he started. And they're all blossoming big churches now with the, churches and good parsonages and high paid preachers. Immediately after this phase of shall we say, organizing suburban churches, my father was appointed district evangelist for the San Antonio district. And that meant that he would hold meetings in churches for pastors who would ask him to. And that was his salary, that whatever they paid him, he lived on. And we lived in San Antonio. And about that time, he had been having a violent urge to get him an automobile, stop riding in a horse and buggy. And he bought a little car, a little Maxwell, red Maxwell car. He loved automobiles. And so he would drive his little car to these towns, and there were no paved roads. They were all, and when he would come home, one of the first things he would say was how many flats he had had, and how many times he was stuck in the mud and had to go walk, and a farmer and a pair of mules would come pull him out. And he'd hold these meetings, and we lived in San Antonio in the house that he built. You know, that was district evangelist. Let me cut that off. Oh, and then I don't remember how long that lasted, but the next appointment he had was presiding elder of the Uvalde district, and that was the district that had come out of probably the San Antonio district. And it consisted, I remember, of 18 churches west of San Antonio. It went Utopia and Rock Springs and Hondo and all those towns up there. And he'd go in his automobile to this place. And he served that 4 years. And he, in later years, he seemed to sort of regret this, but he had established by this time among the preachers, and the bishops knew him as somebody who could get money out of a post almost. And all his life, he was sent to places where there was a debt to raise. And I heard him say one time, I wish I could go somewhere sometime where somebody else had raised the money. And he got tired of digging people. He could, in a way, he enjoyed it. But I think he came to, and he was a very spiritual man. He wanted to convert people. I don't know that he had the power to do so much, but he was a consecrated man. And he sometimes resented that they thought he was just the money getter, because he could get it. And the districts, they depended on the presiding elder to come around and get the money that the preacher couldn't get. And before conference, he would make these wild dashes to every place that was coming up short, and he'd tell these preachers, I don't want a dollar deficit. If you see you can't get it, you call me and I will come. And whenever, and it was quite a name for him, that at conference, none of the other presiding elders did it, but when he gave his report, he would say, Bishop, everything is paid in full. That meant every church, every 18 of these towns paid everything, the preacher's salary, the allotment for missions, whatever was allotted against them to pay, they paid up. And the others didn't do it. Click. Conference time, every preacher was supposed to go to conference. And then they had delegates from the local churches to go also. But there were, and I remember my father saying this, there were little preachers that didn't have the money to get there, or a suit of clothes that they were not ashamed to wear. And that was just awful. But, when annual conference time came, not only was this a time for the preachers to be there and have their say and talk to their presiding elder, and the presiding elder, of course, the bishop would have what he called the bishop's cabinet, consisted of the presiding elders of each of the districts, and he would meet with them, and they would trade preachers, the presiding elders and all. And then also laymen, leading laymen from all churches, any who desired would make their trip to conference and get the bishop's ear and talk about the preacher, good or bad. And usually the trip was made for the latter. They didn't want him back. And that's the way that was decided. And I have heard of times that they would send a delegation up and they'd tell the bishop, we're not going to have him back. And usually he didn't go back. And then another thing that went on in the Methodist Church, whenever a preacher got in trouble, when he stepped over the line, morally or otherwise, laymen would usually squeal on him, and then they would get a committee of preachers close by, and they'd get together and call him on the mat, and he would defend himself or whatever. And then if it was, they thought it was sufficiently bad, they'd take it to the bishop and ask him if he'd bet. My father was never a big preacher. He was a college graduate, and many the Methodist Church at that time, in my time back there, the young preachers were not required, as they are now, to have college education. They may have had very little formal schooling. They may have been studious and educated themselves, yes. But the way they were taken into the conference then, they gave them a, if they had, were not formally educated. And then they didn't go to seminaries like the Episcopal Church, and like our church does now. But they gave them books. They had a committee of this, the educated men in the church, and the bishop passed on it. And they gave them these books to study while they had small charges, starting out before they were full-fledged ordained ministers. They were ministers, but they're not fully ordained. Before they were ordained, they had to pass the examination, which this committee on credentials, I think they... Credentials, would that be?
That sounds right.
Committee on something. Anyway, they had to pass that. And then as time went on, they demanded more in education. And now, of course, to be a preacher, he has to have some education. If he doesn't have it, he can start preaching the gospel, but he's not in the Methodist Church full-fledged until he finishes seminary. Is it on? Well, I remember in my childhood, of course, many that he had something to do with, I didn't. But I went to quite a few. And I remember they'd have one place out west of San Antonio, they had a brush arbor. And he was invited every year to come there and hold a meeting. And they would, many of the people around in this, out in the country, put up tents. They had a regular, they called it to walk in a campground. And it was by a river. And I remember these tents. And then, they had big times. And when there were many people who didn't camp, that drove their wagons and hacks and buggies and very small sprinkling, maybe three or two automobiles. And during this camp meeting, and they would have their dinner on the ground, campfires, and then a lot of them, of course, would go home. No, that was on Sunday. During the day, they had their work to do, and they came at night for the meetings. And they not only had the preacher, which in this case that I remember was my father, but there'd be visiting preachers who would come in, and they would put them up, as they said, to preach. And like as I told you before, my father, he was a very religious man, and he loved to hear strong preachers preach. He just loved to hear evangelists preach. And I remember that in San Antonio, when there was a big noted Baptist preacher holding a meeting, he would go at night and hear him and make himself known, and then usually call on him to pray. And one of these preachers was old Bud Robinson. He was a famous preacher, had a beard all over his face, and the people just come out like bees swarming to hear him. And he had a singer, and they'd sing these rousing hymns and call for mourners, and they'd get out on the knees, and they'd beat them in the back and pray over them, and people would be converted. B.B. Krim was another, I've heard him, Baptist evangelist. When he'd come to San Antonio, and Papa would hear about him, we'd go to hear him and talk to him afterwards and all. He just loved that. And I remember telling, and you know, frequently when he was preaching, and this was the experience of every evangelist. In those days, there'd be some smart-aleck young men that would try to break up the meeting. And they'd come in and sit on the back seat and behave themselves until the singing was over and the praying and the preacher got into his sermon. And then they'd start carrying on their conversation in an audible voice. And the preacher would stop and ask them, that's very disconcerting to any speaker. And he would ask them politely to stop. And then he would proceed and he wouldn't go further than two sentences and they'd start again. And he'd ask them to start again. And usually he'd say, I was taught when I was young to not interrupt others when they were speaking, especially a public speaker. And then he'd say, there is a law that is, that, how shall we say, a law against breaking up, that isn't a good word, but public worship. And usually it would stop, but sometimes it went on until it was sort of embarrassing. And I remember one old preacher telling about, he was a big burly fella, and he was preaching, and one of these thugs in the back was moved by his preaching and came down to the mourner's bench and was seeking the Lord on his knees. And then one of his buddies came up to the mourner's bench, and in a minute another fellow who was praying for him got up and said, preacher, this so-and-so rascal is spitting on our mourners. More than one evangelist that had that experience with fellows that beat a lot of fun, you know, that hear about this revival meeting, and they were going to break it up, and they'd announce they were going to whip the preacher. And so afterwards, while they'd come around and get ready to, they'd stand off, you know, the two or three of them, and one of them come out and I'm going to whip you. And sometimes the preacher would lick them so that's what they're told.
Well, how long did the camp meeting usually last? Was it just
about 10 days, usually.
10 days?
And they'd have it at the time of year that the crops were so that they didn't have to do too much work. Mm-hmm. And all the eating, they would invite the preacher. One reason the preacher, poor preachers could get along on as little money as they did, they were invited to homes to eat so much, and people were so good about giving them things. Well, they were very, very glad when that time passed and they could, were paid a decent living so that they could buy what they wanted instead of just waiting on Sister Jones to bring them a bottle of pickles or.
Yeah. Well, how long, you said that the camp meeting typically lasted 10 days. Well, in that 10 days, would it be a sustained series of meetings and church services day after day? Or would it be a break, say, just a weekend to weekend? Or how?
No, it would, let's see, 10 days or 2 weeks. A lot of times it would go from Sunday to midweek.
Well, how would it start off?
And sometimes longer.
How would it start off? What would it start off with? And then how would it continue? I mean, what all did they do? Was it just a series of meetings?
Well, it would usually start off at a night service with a lot of singing and then preaching and calling for mourners and people to join the church.
What do you mean by mourners?
Well, haven't you heard of the mourner's bench?
No. What is it?
Well, that's just that's an old time saying. Go down to the mourner's bench. That's as close down as you can get to the preacher.
Sort of for the conversion?
And, where you pray for your sins.
Yeah.
the rules of the Methodist Church, written or otherwise, well, it was written in the discipline, though, against worldliness. Now, if you were Methodist, you were not supposed to dance. And you were not supposed to drink liquor. And certainly not lie or be immoral. And play cards. And some of them, that didn't mean that no one did, but when they did, they were backsliders. And when revival came along, you were supposed to repent of your sins and straighten up.
Well, you said that it was prohibited, you know, dancing and drinking and card playing. Was this specifically written down in that discipline that you were talking about? Do you know about that?
I'm not sure that it said dancing, but it made it very clear that any worldliness, cards were tools of the devil, and drunkenness was, well, all those were sin, and I never was allowed to go to dance. Which I think they stretched the point there. I remember that. You see, there are different things when you're a child stick in your memory. I remember what I told you, about the presiding elder of the San Antonio district, and my father saying he made a fabulous salary of $3,000 a year. And,
How did a preacher then supplement his salary? You told me one time about this thing called a pounding. What was that?
That what?
A pounding. What was that? Could you describe that?
Well, when a preacher went to a new charge, you move in this little old parsonage with furnished with the things from the town Methodists they could bear or didn't want.
There's a portion deleted here. Just stand by. The recording resumes in about 15 more seconds.
He was very thrifty. He paid from the time he was a very young preacher, whatever, when his salary was little and when it got better, he always paid a tithe. Did that the first thing. He said the Lord said you could live better on the 9/10 than you could on 10. And you did. The Bible, the one promise that the Bible makes is he will prosper you if you tithe. Bible says it. That's the reason the Baptist Church is so rich.
Why?
They tithe. Yeah. They have more money than they know what to do with. They're good people. And they tithe very religiously. And my father was one of the first ones to preach tithing. People, pastors that had trouble getting money, didn't know how to go about it, would get him to promise to come on a certain date to preach on tithing. When he got through, he got people to sign up that they would promise to tithe. And they would, many of them would tell him, I never have seen anybody who tithed who was not glad that they did, enjoyed doing it, because you had a sense of delight if you had the love of God in your heart to give back this tenth. And many people who tithe paid a little more than the tenth. because and they, I never saw anybody that didn't say that the Lord prospered them. You of course must not do it for that reason. And anybody would be a fool to. Came out to the car and was talking to me not many weeks ago, and her husband had died, and she always talked about you boys and her little business and all, and she said, you know, and talked about her faith in God, and she said, you know, Miss Apple, she said, I'll get along all right. She said, I tithe, and she said, the Lord takes care of me. She said, the other day, a man gave me an air conditioner. He said, I'll get along all right. And she tithes, I'm sure, every dollar she makes.
Well, I was wondering, could you describe that pounding? You know,
well,
what was that exactly?
Darkness would fall, and you'd be... around in your home, the lamps lit, and Papa would start reading, and Mama sewing, maybe, and somebody knock at the door, and then you'd hear blub, 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 come up on the porch, and you'd go to the door, and they'd ah, kind of like happy birthday, surprise, you know. And they'd come in, and this lady would have 2 pounds of sugar, and this lady would have 5 pounds of flour. This lady would have a pound of rice, according to what they could and wanted to do. Everybody just picked up whatever they wanted to do. Some were generous and some gave what they could spare. But that was a big help toward his on a very small salary. And most preachers had a house full of children. It was a big help. It always kind of embarrassed Mom. She didn't let on like it did. She was, Mama was starchy.
And this is what they would do for a preacher who just gotten a new charge or a new assignment.
And it was just abandoned when they got where they paid preachers decent salaries.
Well, how did a preacher know what his new town was going to be? How did he know, when did he know, and how did he know? How did they let him know that?
To a new charge?
Yeah.
Well, on a Sunday afternoon, the bishop would, bishop or some big preacher would preach, and then the bishop would get up and read the appointments, how many presiding elders, and he, his cabinet, they called it, had made them, and he had this piece of paper, and that was it. And he would read that out, and then during the next week, usually by Wednesday night, prayer meeting night, the preacher had moved out, and the new preacher had come in.
Well, was this at any special occasion? Was this like done at camp meetings, or was this done at revivals, or just a certain time of the year that they
it
were?
It used to be every October, and in recent years, very recent years, they decided, and they should have done it years before, that was a bad time for preachers because their children had to change schools in October.
Yeah.
And so now they have it in June.
But they used to do it in October, and no special day, no special occasion, but the reassignment of the preachers. Yeah. It wasn't done like in a camp meeting or...
I used to go to annual conference in St. Marcus when I married Uncle Eddie lived there, Dr. Wall. And then I remember one time going to Uvalde, and preachers take the wives with them. And what they would do when the annual conference would come, you know, people used to enjoy company. So many people raised their own vegetables. Eating was not the expense it is now. People have cow in the backyard and in towns except cities and in outlying districts it isn't cities too. But towns would vie with each other for the annual conference. A preacher would get up, his congregation would instruct him to invite the conference there. And he wouldn't just get up, you know, he'd have to have the church say they want the conference to come. And they'd have that many people say they would entertain the preachers in their homes. And usually the richest member of the church, it used to be the Berries, you know, Nona Berries, Mama and Papa, they'd entertain the bishop at their house. And one year when we were living in San Antonio and the conference met in Beeville, Mama and I didn't go. Papa was entertained at the Berries, he and the bishop, and he was secretary to the bishop. And,
who was the bishop then? Do you remember?
Bishop James Atkins.
About what year was that? Do you remember when that was?
That's probably around 1914, maybe, or 15. Aside from the report of the preachers and presiding elders, there would be a report from the head of colleges telling about their hopes and ambitions and accomplishments, and sometimes ending up with an appeal for more funds. And then missionaries would talk, and they always had an appeal for more funds. And then they would have Negro preachers. I remember during the conference maybe two or three, and that was an appeal. They would preach and make an appeal for money for the African church. See, it was not in the Methodist church like it is now. I mean, it was governed by the Methodist Church, but secular. But the white part helped the black part, and then they'd take a collection for the black preachers, and they also had their schools. They had some colleges, very few, but they would take the collections. And then you were asking a little while ago about the colleges. I remember in San Marcos, I'm pretty sure that I can't tell you the year, when they were going to start a big university called Southern Methodist University in Dallas. And some big men and some big preachers had acquired land and I don't know what all, but they had to raise. They had to get out and raise a lot of money. And my father was one of the first preachers to donate a little money out of his pocket. I mean, a considerable sum for him, paid over a period of time. And then he was delegated to raise some funds.
Before the beginning of Southern
that
Methodist?
That was before there was a brick laid on Southern Methodist University. And you need to put this down, but I'm pretty sure that he was paid one summer to get out and ransack the woods for money. Many preachers were. You know, that was a colossal undertaking to get people to just freely give. And of course, Dallas businessmen paid off big to get that university there. So that's a big institution. A preacher would, it was very rare, but he would be sent to a place that he thought he just couldn't exist, or for some reason he'd refuse to go. I don't think I wouldn't say if I did, but I can't even remember the name. And it was a very rare thing because my father would tell about it when he came home. And I think maybe a poor little preacher with a big family, and he couldn't go to this starvation place and take his, I don't know how they got along. course, doctors were poor then. People didn't pay the doctor bill. They were Baptist preachers and Methodist preachers. Their kids couldn't dance, and they couldn't play cards, and they couldn't do anything. They had went to church on Wednesday night, they went to church all day Sunday. They couldn't play baseball on Sunday or anything like that, and they went to Ephesus League late in the afternoon and went to church on Sunday night. And I remember when we lived in Tomball, Min McGowan, the Baptist preacher's wife, and they were, their kids and our kids went together. And Ms. McGowan was just incensed at Mr. Slack, the band director, having band practice late Wednesday afternoon. She said, he knows that Wednesday is prayer meeting night, and those children can't get off in time to get, and Baptists kind of like Catholics, they didn't go just if they wanted to, they went.
What was this league you mentioned?
The Baptist called it BYPU, and the Methodist called it Ephesus League.
What was that? Was that like what is now?
It's like, what do they call it now?
Methodist Youth Fellowship?
Yeah.
Is that what that was?
And on McKinley Avenue, which is slummy looking now, but everybody then on that street were, they were homeowners, and a lawyer, and there was five or six, I've forgotten which, lots up the street together, this side of Mr. Charlie Hogan's three-story house. And that was right at the time that Papa was holding meeting, starting at McKinley Avenue Church. And I think he bought those lots for $500 or $600 for let's see. He went to the bank. He always had bankers that would lend him money. I ought to really go back to Corpus. But anyway, he went to the bank and borrowed the money. You see, he could see. He went to the bank and borrowed the money to buy those five or six lots, I forget which. And as soon as he got those lots, he'd sell off all except one. And he sold off enough of those lots to make his lot clear with a little bit left over. And then he borrowed the money and made notes for $1,800 to build us a nice five-room house. I ought to show you that house sometime.
Where was this located then?
On McKinley Avenue. That's where I lived when I married. I was pastor there the second time.
What church?
And that big church. McKinley Avenue Methodist Church. Where I was married.
What year was that?
Well, he built our house. I think I was about 1913. Yeah. And Mama despised living in parsonages. She always said she wasn't cut out for a preacher's wife, and she wasn't. She didn't want to be a preacher's wife. And after he was evangelist, and they made him presiding elder of the Uvalde district, you see, that's the most responsible position, except the big city churches like First Lake, Houston, Travis Park, the biggest jobs under the bishop. He was on the Uvalde district 4 years, and they didn't have a parsonage out there because it was a new district, and we lived in our home. Well, that suited her just fine. And then he went from there to be pastor of Beeville. He was tickled to death. He had met people from Beeville, and I had heard him say before he was sent to Beeville, I was about 15 then, that Beeville was the finest town and the finest people. Just loved the people in Beeville. And you really enjoyed living there and being pastor of that church. And that wooden church, you don't remember the wooden church, do you?
Vaguely. I've seen pictures of it, and I think that's made me...
Well, you kind of should. You were little, very little.
I remember the annex, because we used to have Sunday school there.
But that was a pretty fine church, the old...
The name of the church when he was in Uvalde, and back then, what was the name of the overall Methodist church? Was it Methodist or Methodist Episcopal?
Methodist Episcopal Church South.
Excuse me.
I feel sure they had not dropped the South then.
Where did he get the name South? Where did he get the name South?
The Civil War. When the Civil War came on, you know, everything below the Mason-Dixon line was South, and other was North. Everybody that listened to him, he was always telling me on that he was, went somewhere, to, he was at some church to preach back in, during the years, I don't know how far back, but anyway, he went to a little church to preach, and there was nobody to play the old rattletrap piano, and somebody said, well, the few plays, and so he went over and said to Miss So-and-so, would you play for us? And they said, oh, yes, you can. And so she got up, went on, get on the piano stool, and she said to my father, well, I don't know anything to play. And he said, well, just play it. And so they sang a song, and then they went to take up the offering, and she played Listen to the Mockingbird, Listen to the Mockingbird. He had told her to play anything, what he meant. Any song out of the hymn. Where's the fishes?
I didn't get the song.
I thought of what was very different. From when I was a little girl and a very young girl, especially in the smaller churches, they now have an order of worship very similar to the Episcopal church and goes right back, printed and followed. But used to be, especially in the small churches, the preacher would get up and bring his Bible and put it on the lectern and announce he'll sing such and such a number. And they would sing such a number, and then they'd let us pray, and he would either pray or call on one of the brethren, probably both. And some of those prayers were long and drawn out. And then he'd sing and call out as many songs as he wanted to. And they had a volunteer choir that they just came up when they wanted to and sat out in the choir and sang. And the organist, which is usually some jealousy connected with that, it was just whatever fat lady got on the organ first. Organ Bench was right here in Beeville a long time ago. About three of them. And then he would make announcements, and usually they were too long, and exhort people to come to things, send the children to Sunday school, and anything that he could think of, or maybe if it was a district meeting in the thing, and then about the Missionary Society, and on, shorter, long, and more prayers, and more singing, and then finally he'd get around to preaching. And when I was young, if it deserved it, or maybe didn't deserve it.
Amen. Amen.
And that got precious lesser and lesser. But and during revival meetings, you know, between where the church is, and it's approximately where the old church was, and what is the annex. They used to have a smaller building there, similar to the one, like I was saying, that was the first church at McKinley Avenue. Well, they called it the bungalow, and they had used it for just what they used this on the church. Wasn't that big. Then in between that, and there were many more street trees, they had one summer a famous, marvelous preacher who was pastor of University Church, Austin, Bob Fuller. And he was young and vigorous and a marvelous preacher, and the people just packed into him. And he held a meeting there. The men built this brush arbor. And then when any evangelist held a meeting, then when he would have said his message and give out the invitation to come give their lives to the Lord, the saints of the congregation would go around to the, and I don't mean to be making fun of anything, because some of them were saints and some of them weren't, and they'd go around to the sinners that they thought were sinners, and they'd plead with them to come down and give the priest the hand, kneel down, and get rid of their sins. And they would sometimes, some people who love to do that work would just start to come down the aisle and, "Are you a Christian?" "Are you a Christian?" And there was a big old woman named Miss Simmons, was a kind of a practical nurse, and she was a good old thing, but obviously not all ignorant as she could be, and she just wasn't real bright. She must have definitely had a shine on Papa. But she was enthusiastic about her religion when they tell these people to go out and talk to the sinners. Miss Simmons would be one of the first ones she'd see in history, and not the least good practice for them. And they said that she'd go down the line, and the young people would be sitting in the back of your kitchen, and all say yes. Whether they were or not, whether they were, it could have been infidels. "Are you a Christian?" "Yes." "Are you a Christian?" And every last one of them said, "Yes." And she says, "They're pretty good stuff, ain't it?" I don't know why somebody made that up in my And then about the things that that people can, I know every preacher had this experience of people coming to them with their troubles. Maybe it was a son that was out of line, and old women. Women can be so silly. Old women, I remember right here in Beville, and I wouldn't say Beville because people know who I'm talking about. That was in the horse and buggy days. There were two women, good women, with big families, and with grown daughters, and they'd come knock at the door, or maybe call on the phone and want to have a conference. And he'd take them in the parlor, living room, probably. And they'd tell, just nearly weep about this daughter, then this suitor that they didn't approve of, because maybe he was a Carmelite or a Baptist or a Catholic or maybe nothing. And one of the things in the world that the preacher could do about it. But he had to sit there and listen, and maybe see her get some tears about it. And then sometimes they'd come and tell about differences they had with people, accuse them of cheating them of all kind of rascality. And for what obvious reason? Just to get sense there, I guess. And he didn't know who was there.
You'll
be fine. Well, just and maybe Catholics go to this priest or things like that. But
you said that at one time that they used to sometimes during the process of the church ceremony, they replied to what the preacher was saying in his sermon or in his prayer. They'd say amen, mm-hmm. or something like that.
And niggers, you know, do that still. That's why niggers started, I guess, hearing the white folks, and they elaborated on it. Oh, and he used to preach for the niggers. He loved niggers. And he preached for the niggers, and he said he loved to tell yarns on himself. Because he got through preaching, was over there to all thank him and talk to him. And one of them came up to him and said, "Reverend Dale, you're preaching more like a nigger than a man I am." You know, that's so funny.
Well, when did the...
They meant that for coffee.
Yeah. How about the prayer meetings?
Oh, well, the prayer meetings would have just a few, little few, little prayer meetings. And he would read the scripture and then talk about it. And and those were real good, helpful spiritual meetings, because nobody wasted the time going to that didn't truly want to get close to the Lord. And finally, as the church waxed stronger and richer, then you need too much spirituality.
How long
to get away with it?
Didn't you say that this usually happened on Wednesday night? Mm-hmm. And how long was it, like a half an hour?
Possibly under an hour. And sing a couple of songs and have maybe two prayers. And sometimes somebody besides the preacher would talk too.
But it was pretty informal, I guess.
Yes, and really good meetings for anybody that's sincere.
How about Bible school back when you were a girl?
All that other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a superintendent and different classes. And in those days, I read where many a good man in print had testified that he had been set on the right road and inspired by some woman or man that he thought was a godly person. And they really tried to show young people and children the love of God and the love of their fellow man, and everything that they knew of and believed in that was right. Oh, and you know, two things I left out. I said San Antonio and Beville. At San Antonio, he was sent to Kyle. My mama got sick. And from Kyle, he went to Corpus, which was a good step up. They had two-story Corpus and a big wooden church. And they were just delighted. When Mama got over this illness, she couldn't walk, had to learn to walk over.
When he was in San Antonio, what was the name of the church that he had there in San Antonio? Was that the
McKinley
Avenue Church? And then, do you remember the name of the church in town?
His first Methodist church out.
Mm-hmm. And
still is one church there, a small town.
And what was the size congregation? Do you remember that, or would you have any way of knowing that in San Antonio, and then when moved to Beville? How, what was it back then, do you recall? Kind of hard, I suppose.
Yes. I don't know. It was I could be just as wrong
but I imagine in San Antonio, not over 200, because they didn't all come to church.
And
BBL, I would think maybe 400. Could have been a little more, a little less.
How about performing weddings for a young couple?
And you know, when we go back to the order of worship, like I said, it's very informal then. It has gradually gotten so we follow it, and I like that. It's, if you open the Episcopal order of worship in the prayer book, it's the devil goes down on. How about what?
Weddings?
Oh, well. That was a little source of income, and as time went on more, and you know, during the First World War, Papa was pastor at McKinley, and it had gotten to be a pretty big church then, and a man down at the courthouse, you see, there were five or six camps right around Beville on the San Antonio. Kellyfield and Brookfield and Fort Sam and I don't know, Kelly, and these soldiers were marrying all the time, and down at the where they got the license, this fellow knew Papa, and if this soldier may not have known a preacher in 1,000 miles, and this fellow was giving Papa's name and address, and the telephone would ring, and this man would ask him, bring this young lady out and just play their morning before. And he'd always give that money to Mama and me divided. It usually was $5, sometimes 10, sometimes more. And he married a couple one time in Beeville, and I think this man gave him $10 maybe. Maybe a little more, probably $10. And for I don't know how many years after, this man would send him at Christmas time $10, telling him that he need to spend that much more for such a good wife. Wasn't that cute?
Did anybody ever ask him how much it was worth, or how much they had to pay, or did they?
Oh, they always did. Yeah.
What would he say?
Oh, that's you. I told you about Bishop Smith telling him when he was a young preacher, he first charged with a rural place, and a little boy came in and got married, walking out my clothes. Oh, it's up to you. He went out and got a sack of sweet potatoes out of the back of his buggy. Didn't she have a bite too?
Well, Bishop Smith, what was his first name, do you know? Bishop?
A. Frank Smith. He was pastor at law. He was a marvelous dog. Pastor of Law Heights. And one time, First Church Houston. And then when they made him bishop, he was in the Houston living. He was in Houston living.
What about funerals? Were they any different than they are now?
My funerals, so often they had funerals in the home. People then, you know, show their emotions so much more than they do now. There's weeping and crying and sometimes singing at funerals. And we just think they're terribly emotional. And it was the bad thing, and all preachers did it then, was to preach a pretty long sermon, which is so hard on people. And would eulogize the dead, which me, I don't want anybody ever say anything good about me. It maybe anything good to say. But listen, that is for God Almighty to judge. And I don't believe in it, and I don't want it. And they get up and preach these sermons and tell, and I heard a preacher tell this, this is an old saw, that at a funeral, the father, husband had died, and this preacher was standing there just telling what a pure white saint he was, and the wife leaned over to one of the bars and said, "Uncle, let's see if that's off." It's awful. But that is, it was so different from what you knew about him. Of funerals and weddings, and always they went to see the sick. And a good preacher did whatever he could. Papa's gone out of town many a time when people were sick out of town. He'd make a trip out of town to see them. And, well, he just did a whole lot of good things.
What was his, if he had anything that you could, I'm sure it probably wasn't real ordered, but what was a typical week in his pastoral life? I mean, what would be a typical week, say, starting the day after a service? What would he do, say, Monday through up till the next service? I mean, I'm sure he had to go out and see people, and he'd work on his sermon at times, but was there any set pattern to that he would be, like on one day he'd work on a sermon?
Yes, and always on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
But on Monday, he usually did things that he needed to do, like cleaning up his yard,
mm-hmm.
or later washing his car, anything that he needed personally to be done for his family or himself. And if anything, frequently there were things of church nature that were taken care of on that. And then other times it was usually just Paul. And they had district meetings, they had steward meetings. Stewards ran the church and either helped the preacher or gave him a bad time, whichever they wanted to do.
Well, did the stewards, I know that there was a board.
That's board of stewards.
That's right. And they, didn't they, more or less
set
control
the salary and collected the money and got together and decided whether they wanted to ask for the preacher to come back to try to get him moved.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had a board of trustees. There's usually men that knew more about finance. He had had charge of the church property, like the church proper and the parsonage or any other that they might have, like the church now has, and all churches got considerable real estate.
Is a revival, what we call a revival now, is that the same thing that a camp meeting was back then? Was there any distinction? Did they have what they called a revival then, separate from a camp meeting?
Well, a camp meeting was what it said it was. They camped.
Mm-hmm.
And it was out in the country, rural district. And revival meetings were of the same nature, only they were usually held in the church building. And on a small scale, it's what Billy Graham is doing now.
Yeah.
He's preaching just what they preached then, except he's
on a bigger scale. didn't have usually a regular choir in either the Beeville or the McKinley Avenue Church in San Antonio.
Well, it was pretty regular. And they had choir practice. But right there in Beeville, like I said, there was jealousy of the organist. And the ones that sang the solos.
You used to participate in that once in a while, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
I heard from a lot of people that you were real good.
And one lady, the big fat lady and a fine Christian woman, she was the mother of Lord Gregory, who became managing head for the Houston Post, one of the big men in Houston. And I can show the house they live in just before you get to the bridge on St. Mary's. And her husband was in the dry goods business in a little store there where Conley's drugstore is. And he died. Oh, and Lloyd used to write about his mother in the Houston Post once in a while. And he said that the height of her glory and ambition was when she could entertain preachers in her home. That was, she didn't stick to always on Saturday, was getting ready for Sunday.
Would he start the sermon then?
Well, maybe it was on it before then, but he had to really work Saturday. He, at night during the week, he would do some reading, maybe, and I don't know what it is, just reading his Bible. But a Saturday, he'd really get into it. I remember in Corpus, I had this two-story parsonage, and mom was just recovering from that long sickness. I don't know how she did it. We had more company in that place, preachers. And at first, she didn't have a wheelchair or anything. She couldn't walk. And she'd sit in a rocking chair and pull it around like this and do a chair. Well, she was determined to learn to walk then. She did.
She hadn't learned to walk over yet.
But she's been dead so long.
Did he ever, to your knowledge, did he ever have any real problems with, say, the board over any members? Or I was just wondering how much influence the board actually had. Did they ever tell him anything about y'all, about your family? Or I doubt that he would. I've read accounts of some preachers who had problems with their board.
Well, and they did, many of them with their children, too, because people were so critical. And some of them need to be criticized. Now, I don't put any bouquets for me to smell, but I didn't get out of line. I was an only child. I didn't have much chance to. Maybe I wanted to. And I did and went where they said I could and nowhere else. And, I remember in Beeville one time. Oh, yes, I remember this. An old woman said that I went with a crowd to a dance. Listen, Elna and Marge and Anna Brown and all those girls, they didn't have dances very often. When they did, I had to stay at home. And I had plenty of bows, would-be bows. Wouldn't let me go with all of them. I didn't get out of line. And my papa was so mad he couldn't see straight. And he really got on those.
Well, they had said you did what? You went out with a...
That I went to a dance.
Yeah.
And the thing of it is, it wasn't right to say I did. I didn't have the pleasure of it. Mm. Now, there were preacher's kids that I didn't know of it personally, but the people would tell about how they told about an old preacher in Corpus before Papa went there. He was a very little kid then. That this man was a widower, and he had about an 18-year-old daughter. And she come out on that upstairs porch with face down toward the town. I ain't sure where it was. And she slide down that post and meet a boyfriend and kick up her heels. I don't think anybody ever said that she was notoriously bad, but she was just kind of wild.
So apparently he had a pretty amicable relationship with his board of stewards, though. I mean,
oh yes,
they weren't real overbearing.
No, nobody was ever real bad to him. I started telling you there was a family in Beeville, and I wouldn't want this to be because he's still living. They had a family of boys, and these boys would come and talk to Papa. They'd get in trouble, and their father was a big Methodist and a pretty smart man. He's a Yankee. And these kids would tell Papa that he was mean to them. They wouldn't give him any spending money. And but one of the boys was caught snitching money and got in trouble. And Papa told him to come see him, and he would, and he'd talk to him, try to talk to him so that it would help him. And one of these kids told him that, well, the reason they did it, he never would give them any money. And this was after he, part of it, after he retired in Beeville. And he said, when you're in a jam and need a little pocket change, and you can't get it, you come and I'll help you. I don't know whether that came or not. Mona knows about that. Barber shop the hair. The way it started out, somebody would need some hair trim, and he'd get scissors and do it, and they found out that he could do a pretty good job and didn't cost anything. And he was cutting so many of them that he got to charging them. He was a poor boy, and let's see, he did that.
That was at that Centenary College. And he did that to help put his
wife
through school.
And he did something else. And then the first little church they gave him after they let him in the church, and they got married. I mean, they married, and this little church just paid him a little scratch or something, and they had a little parsonage. Mom said they used apple boxes for furniture and matches for kindling. And then to supplement enough for them to have a living on, he taught school. Little one room from first grade to man-sized boys. And she would do her work at home. When she got through, she'd go to school and help him teach.
What town was this?
I'm not sure, but it was one of the first places where he was. I remember them telling about a long time ago. It was in Corpus. And I remember years after telling about this, some woman joined the church, the Methodist church, and then she called on my father, said she had read in the Bible where in the early days in Christ's time, they anointed with oil. And she wanted the old works. She wanted my father to anoint her with oil. And he had such a sense of humor. He said he almost couldn't stand it that it amused him so that he never had heard of a preacher, a Protestant preacher, annoying anybody at all. He wouldn't know how to do it, or didn't believe that it should be done. And I don't know what was ever done about it.
Was baptism any source of money? They didn't charge for that like they did for weddings. Did they?
And they didn't charge for weddings.
Yeah, it was just whatever they wanted to pay.
If some of them just wanted to walk out, say thank you. Well, that was all right. It wasn't all right, but it was legal.
Well, when you were a young girl and you would be in a church service, did they ever have any trouble with, or did they even pay any attention to people who would go to sleep in the church? Or was any attention ever made to that? I didn't know.
Well, the preacher would notice, and when he'd come home, he'd laugh about it and get half mad about it, because I think that'd be a distraction. Not a big congregation anyway. And, I can remember people, men especially, that as soon as he gets started and go to sleep, preachers were supposed to call on everybody in every home in the church. Not once, but all through the years. And that was a source of pleasure and a means of help for lots of people. And usually in those days, people were glad for the preacher to come see them. It's a source of worry now. People don't want the preacher to come. And especially if they don't call, you know, like everybody. If you go see anybody now, you call and say, I'll be over down four if it's convenient or something, or you may not find him at home. But, he'd call, make pastoral calls, whether they were home or not. Sometimes they were, sometimes they weren't. But that was the part that was stressed for preachers to go in to the home and call.
That was expressed in the discipline, wasn't it? That was one of the...
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
And like I say, back in the old days, they were invited many, many times to go and fetch this Sunday dinner, and times it wasn't Sunday, they'd show up around meal time, they were invited, of course. Every preacher, especially where they got up, not making big salaries like they do now, but making a living. And I remember in Beeville and San Antonio too, the calls that he'd have, people coming to his door, men and women, and mostly men, big strapping men sometimes, outright asking for a little money because they didn't have any. Hard luck tale, and some of them were just playing deadbeat. And a lot of them were destitute. And many, many times he would help them a little. And if they'd find people who were in, I remember during the Depression, he was pastor the second time in Beeville. That was during the Depression. And there was a stream, and every preacher had it, every denomination, I'm sure the priest, people asking for help, telling me, I am hungry, I'm out of a job. You know, people were committing suicide and awful times. And I know that Mama was scared, and I was scared, because at night we'd see sometimes he'd go to the door and there'd be three men or two men, and they'd want money. He couldn't dish out money to all of them. Sometimes he'd say, well, I'll give you an offer, and that's all I do. Sometimes he'd say, I'll give you a $2 for your order, and sometimes he'd go rustle up something to eat. And I remember when, who was the baby then? Maybe Mona. I don't know who, but I remember more than one time him coming in and saying, I've got to get hold of some diapers and a little baby dress or two, and he'd pick up a bottle of castor oil and go out on the road where somebody was parked in an old covered truck with a baby, sick baby maybe, and it just break him up. And this, these people wouldn't, he'd give them that little bit and maybe take some groceries or maybe go out and get Dobie or somebody to help him and take stuff out there. And this woman was crying, thanking him. They'd go on their way.
Which,
well, there's much of that.
Which Miss Dobie was that?
J. Frank Dobie's mother, who was a saint.
You used to go with who?
Henry, he was J. Frank's youngest brother. And Miss Dobie was
they Methodist?
Oh, they were the fellows of the church. And you know where they lived? You know where the Rosses lived?
Yeah.
They built that home.
Is that right?
And
right
I went
there on Bowie Street?
Eating dinner up there with preachers and mom and papa. And, oh, they were wonderful people. Mm-hmm. Miss Fanny taught up in high school. And I never knew Frank. I just saw him after, because he was off getting his education. And that she had, I forgot Bertha, maybe, on what J. Frank Dobie's wife's name was. I never see her. And I didn't know him. I just met him. He was always gone whenever we would be there. But she wrote her and asked her.
Since the tape sessions had taken the better part of both a Saturday morning and afternoon, 22nd January 1972, and since the subject of a pioneer preacher evangelist, Brother Samuel Barnes Bell, the Methodist Episcopal Church South had been adequately covered for the purposes of this interview. With this digression by my most excellent grandmother, Mrs. Lucille Bell Southwell, I concluded this tape recording.